All right, it's Phil Lee returning again with Inside Digital Media and one of our favorite guests, Jim Berger, who is an intellectual property attorney in Washington City at Dow Lonis. What?
You got it that time, Dow Lonis. Very good.
Okay, Dow and Albertson, right?
Right.
Okay, well, we're going to be, just for those of you in the audience, you've noticed that we've started podcasting our interviews, and the audio-only interviews are going to be podcast. The WebEx interviews will continue to be the same way, where you both watch and hear them at your computer, because the WebEx interviews do have visual elements. But for the audio interviews only, they're going to be available not only at the website, but also via podcasting.
Well, now I'm going to have to get an iPod.
Well, actually, you can. Well, that's a longer story, but
yes,
it works well with an iPod. I just wanted to encourage those of you in the audience that want to help others discover the content that we have here at the program and the interviews that we do. Go to podcastalley.com, and you can vote for the Inside Digital Media show and also put down your comments. It's kind of a clearinghouse, kind of like at amazon.com. If you want to go learn about a new book that's been published, you can read the reviews of the people that, just regular members, and it's the same sort of thing. Anyway, the reason for having Jim on the show today is you recently filed a brief on behalf of your clients in the Supreme Court for the Grokster case. So why don't we start off with, disclose
sure.
who your client is.
People know. So, right. We represented Intel before the Supreme Court. We filed what's called an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief.
Okay.
Not on behalf of Grokster, and I can say a little more about that in a moment, but on asking the Supreme Court to affirm the Ninth Circuit's decision. And we'll obviously later get into the details of that.
Okay, well,
I just want to make it clear I'm speaking for me, though, not for Intel.
All right, Jim is speaking for Jim and not for Intel. Okay, but for those in the audience, again, just refresh their memory. Why is this case before the Supreme Court? What is the case before the Supreme Court? What does your brief say?
Sure. Well, first of all, and of course there's a little bit of bias in my case, it's probably the most important copyright case we've had the past 20 years since the Sony Betamax decision. Indeed, the concern people have is what's being asked here, is that decision be eroded or overturned. Grokster and Streamcast, as most of your listeners probably know, distribute peer-to-peer applications. They're also able to send advertising, which is how they make their money, to people using that peer-to-peer software. The distinction, looking at just the software for the moment, is the fact that that software doesn't have a central server. It has a couple different, two different ways depending which version you're using, but basically uses supernodes, finds the most powerful user computers and turns those into indexing servers, so that if you get on their service and you look for a particular file, you're going to some user's computer who's a supernode, and they know where that file is, assuming another user who's online has it.
How does a user become a supernode? Does that have an inadvertent?
You don't know. The software automatically runs, or we'd say autonomously, runs out there and picks what it believes to be the most powerful computer. So often they're university computers.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is. As long as they have the client software installed on it, any computer can act as a supernode.
Well, but it also has to have the shared folder open, right?
No. Not if you're the supernode. That's on the other client's computers. If I'm just a client and I've got all the Grateful Dead on my computer in the sharing folder, that supernode computer, even if it has nothing in its folder, will index the song title and the artist title.
Okay.
Of mine, of everyone who's connected
to
that supernode.
So, but to become a supernode, you have had at one point or another had to have installed the...
Yes, you have to install the client software. That's correct. And then it has to be not disabled somehow. That's, from a legal point of view, what's important about that is that Napster, who was found guilty, the old Napster, not the new one, the old Napster maintained the central server itself. And under what we call secondary copyright liabilities, that is, you weren't a primary violator, Napster itself never copied anything.
Well, yeah, okay, but it's interesting what you say, and I'm not trying to be too abrupt here, but you've really got me fascinated on this point.
Sure, go ahead.
It's interesting what you say, though. Apparently computers at universities without the knowledge of the administrators have become supernodes.
Assuming somebody put the client software on, as you noted.
Okay, yeah. So,
and that would likely be a pretty powerful computer. But
So what you're saying is that at least kids can get in the computer labs, and the computer labs are open all night, and you can't police everything, right? So,
right. If you're not policing what applications or have some restrictions on people putting applications on your computers, you could wind up in your university, and assuming you haven't turned off the port that allows peer-to-peer to work, you're likely to have that software on your computers.
Okay, so what that means is that even though that supernode is not itself sharing any files,
right,
it becomes a directory.
Yeah, it becomes an indexing server.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think the Streamcast software works slightly differently, but it's a similar idea. Neither Streamcast nor Grokster maintain indexing servers, so they can truly say they have no idea what's flowing over their network, as opposed to Napster, who, because the old Napster had the indexing servers in-house, the court found that they were contributorily and vicariously liable, secondarily liable, in aiding or controlling, having an ability and right to control people who were violating the Copyright Act.
Yeah, let's just for to straighten out the nomenclature here, let's refer to them as the original Napster.
The original Napster.
Okay, right. because Chris Gorar's company has had two versions of Napster, which are legal.
Right. Oh yeah, absolutely legal, and I don't want to throw stones at
semantics there.
Right. It's very important.
So we'll call that the original Napster, right, which has been dead and gone for 3 years.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so,
but it's a legal principle. The legal principles are alive.
Yeah.
Now the problem with the case before the Supreme Court is that the Supreme Court doesn't have the whole case. What happened was, in an understandable rush to try and close down Streamcast and Napster, the entertainment company plaintiffs asked for summary judgment and partial summary judgment, as did the Grokster and Streamcast defendants. And the court, the trial court, said, okay, we will take a look at the current version of the software and any activities subsequent to that version. And basically what then you were saying is the distribution of peer-to-peer software, and nothing more, a secondary violation of copyright law? In other words, is it bad to distribute technology that is capable of copying? And the judge looked at it, and he looked at the Sony case, the famous Supreme Court Sony case, where the Supreme Court says, no, you're not guilty of secondary liability as long as your product is being used for substantially non-infringing purposes or is capable, merely capable of substantial non-infringing uses. And there's a long sort of legal history behind that, but essentially what they were saying is, look, you make a screwdriver, right? And you can use a screwdriver to jimmy doors open, but you also can use a screwdriver to do a lot of constructive work around the house and building buildings. So the fact that you make screwdrivers and someone uses them for bad purposes doesn't make you an aider and abettor of the crime.
Yeah, and so the Ninth Circuit Court, which is, was that the
San Francisco, it's in the West Coast.
That's an appellate court.
Yes, that's the Circuit Court of Appeals. Most ordinarily, decisions of a district court, federal district court, are appealed to the circuit court in the area, in the Ninth Circuit.
Okay, so this is now, and the Supreme Court has said, what specifically are they looking at?
Well, that's the problem here, because to read the entertainment industry's brief to the Supreme Court, they go on about the terrible acts that Streamcast and Grokster did, that they advertised they were going to be the next original Napster. They, in their manuals, they told people how to download copyrighted software. There's a lot of facts that are alleged. The problem is none of those facts are before the Supreme Court, because the trial judge excluded those, and the plaintiffs, the entertainment industry, agreed to exclude those facts. And the problem is, for a lot of the, mainly the consumer electronics, telecommunications, and information technology industry, is that what's facing the Supreme Court is, can technology by itself be bad, to put it very simply? Or if somebody can use your technology to infringe copyright, are you guilty too? And this is what, has scared many of the technology companies, and not just in our industry. This is a very, very hotly contested case before the Supreme Court.
What did you say in your brief on behalf of Intel?
Well, what we said is that, look, unauthorized distributing and copying copyright works is wrong. We don't approve of a business that bases itself on people violating other people's copyright. And we said that it wouldn't bother Intel if ultimately Streamcast and Grokster were found liable for contributory infringement if the trial court ultimately finds those facts. But the problem here is that those facts aren't before the Supreme Court. As I said earlier, that all the court's looking at is the technology. And so, as a consequence, what the entertainment industry is asking the Supreme Court to do, in our view, is to overrule the Clear Sony case, although they don't admit it. And because the problem is, one of the things that the trial court did find, and the entertainment industry didn't dispute, was that the technology, the Streamcast and Grokster technology, quote, is being used and could be used for substantial non-infringing purposes. And so if you challenge the district court decision, what you're saying, Phil, is that, you know, we got to turn over Grokster. And even if you have nothing to do with the infringement, you just make a tool, you could be guilty of copyright infringement. And what's really frightening is, frankly, there were some 30 briefs filed, including the entertainment industry, on what we call the top side. Those are briefs that either were the entertainment industry petitioners or friends of the court, amici as we call them, supporting their case, or neutral briefs. Now, there are a couple of neutral briefs that made the same point Intel did, frankly, the Digital Media Association and the Business Software Alliance also supported maintaining Sony. So what we're concerned, and the other briefs, though, propose all these different kinds of tests that would say, if you don't pass this test, you are guilty.
Okay, what are some of those tests? Because, I find, the thing that I find here kind of confusing is, when the original Xerox machine came out,
right,
it clearly had both infringing uses and non-infringing uses. There's nothing to prevent me from going to a Xerox machine, 40 years ago, and
sure,
copy all the books I wanted.
Absolutely, and
but why didn't that become...
Because of the Sony case.
Yeah, but the Sony case wasn't until the 80s.
Well, because the frank matter was, the book publishers weren't concerned.
Okay.
It wasn't until, the interesting case is post-Sony, is the Texaco case, where companies would buy one copy of a very expensive, very short scientific paper and make bunches of copies and distribute it all over the company. And they said that
Texaco did that.
Yes, and they were sued by the publisher, one of the scientific paper distributor, the publishers. And, Sony and Texaco said, it's fair use, like Sony. And the court said, no, that's not fair use. You're a corporation. You're depriving them of revenue. It's not like an individual. The Sony case essentially said, look, there's a substantial non-infringing use for the tape deck, even though a lot of people weren't doing it at that point, which is copying for time-shifting purposes television shows that some of the television producers don't mind you're copying for that purpose. But you, Texaco, it's not a fair use. You're doing it for commercial purposes. So that's the important distinction, was that Texaco was directly violating the Copyright Act by making copies. Sony, of course, was producing a videotape recorder, which you could use to violate copyright. You could, for example, tape a movie, back in the early 80s, you could tape a movie, right, off the television, and then you could make lots of copies and go out in the street corner and sell it. That would be clearly a copyright violation.
Yes, it would be.
But the court said, I'm sorry, Sony is not guilty of secondary infringement, of aiding these people, because their machine is capable of non-infringing uses. The same thing with a Xerox copier.
Yeah, and this principle seems to make a lot of sense to me. But what you're saying is that there's a lot of briefs filed that says, well, this principle needs to be adjusted and additional tests needs to apply.
So right.
Tell us, what would they like to see as additional tests?
It's funny. Our friend, the movie and record industry, has three different tests. One is if there's the primary use test. And, the number they throw around is 90%. And then they have a separation test.
See, now, I don't like the primary use test because, and this is the way I started off this program, podcasting.
Oh, absolutely.
Podcasting wasn't around Well, you know, when the iPod was invented, it just wasn't around. But it's clearly becoming something that's, you know, I think is significant.
Well, I'll skip to the end of our argument, which is there's a much more important issue. You're looking at it in the middle. I look at it at the beginning.
Okay.
Because what it's saying to an innovator, it's saying to the designer of the iPod, you know, before it's ever gotten on the market, you know what? You got to figure out what the primary use of this is going to be. You got to figure out over time. And, you know, you got to figure out, some of these tests would also say, how can you, you know, what particular protection should you build into it? You know, if you're an innovator or a venture capitalist, you go, the risk is too great, because the downside of all this is the statutory damages provision.
Well,
which could add up very fast. We calculated here that it could be $24 billion at maximum. That's the maximum willful violation. $24 billion. I mean, that's a lot of money even for Microsoft or Intel.
I remember interviewing Scour. You may not remember them, but they were very distant to second to the original Napster. And it was a bunch of young guys in their late teens and early 20s. And even though they had, I think, Ovitz money in there, they closed down, they said, because of the statutory infringement, they said, exceeded the gross national product of Sweden.
Yeah, now that's exactly the problem here. So if you're an innovator, it's going to make you timid, and it's really a serious problem. Because it's funny, one of the things we said in the brief was we looked at three really incredible inventions over the past centuries.
Okay.
And if you take each of the three, none of them actually became used extensively for the primary purpose they were invented for. Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone not because he was trying to transmit voice, but he had figured out by using different tones you could send more than one telegram over a telegraph wire at the same time, sort of multiplexing, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, he convinced one of the first venture capitalists in the country to invest in his product because of that use. By the way, he married his daughter. But it turned out, of course, that one night he woke up and said, "Eureka, we could use this to transmit voice." Edison invented the wax cylinder, the record, to eliminate the need to send business letters. It wasn't until a licensee of his technology figured out, hey, music might sound good on this. And then the laser, which is, of course, pervasive in many different applications, was invented because the two scientists thought coherent light would be a neat way to study molecules. So the problem is innovators don't know and can't predict how their technology is going to be used.
Yeah, and this really ties back to the example I was trying to think of. I had a guest on earlier, and I'd just like to make this point because it's really germane to peer to peer. He's a podcaster, and he says, "Look, what we need to do, think about podcasting as being more than just audio. It can be video as well."
Sure.
And a really powerful software tool for distributing that is BitTorrent.
Oh, BitTorrent's really interesting.
Yeah. So but BitTorrent is plain vanilla. Peer-to-peer. So if podcasting becomes important and video podcasting becomes important and BitTorrent is the best platform for distributing it, the fact that peer-to-peer might have been 90% illegal use when Sean Fanning's Napster got started would have never permitted BitTorrent and podcasting to become what they can.
Absolutely. And you sound like there were a number of briefs filed on what we call the bottom side on the same side, which make that point. There was a brief filed by a bunch of artists, musicians, who basically said the music industry doesn't speak for us. And they gave terrific examples how careers have been rescued, how artists that aren't signed reach out and get followings and actually can make a living because of peer-to-peer. You're absolutely right. We don't know, ultimately, how a given technology will be used.
Yeah, so the 90% test, I don't like that test. So
let's pick another one.
Yeah, well, what are the other two tests?
The movie record people, the second one is the separation test. So that when you can separate infringing from non-infringing uses, then you should be found guilty if you don't do the separation. Now, this sounds innocuous, but they're talking about filtering, which was interesting. It was even back in the Sony case, it was argued that Sony should be found guilty because the studios had figured out a way to jam the recorder. They could put a jamming signal. We now call it Macrovision. Well, it's not the same thing they were proposing, but it is like Macrovision. They could jam the recording, and Sony had created an anti-jammer, so they should be found guilty, and the court just didn't consider that. The minority did, but the majority didn't. But they're saying filtering. And there's a whole bunch of problems with filtering, which is we don't really know whether it'll work. I mean, it's before the district court, but how is a court going to analyze whether it'll work? And secondly, even if it works initially, it's going to be hacked. You and I know that.
Okay.
And so what do you have to do? You now have to go after the hack, and then when that hack, the anti-hack gets hacked, you've got to do an anti-anti-hack. You know, this idea that there's nothing in the law that says you have to change your technology to protect content. In fact, in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Congress specifically said that technology companies didn't have to change their technology to recognize content protection systems. They just couldn't go out and affirmatively break them. Now, the government has even a different test, believe it or not.
No, those are the two tests.
The third test is that you have to show that the legitimate, unobjectionable purposes are commercially successful.
Wow.
And you're not depending on the illegitimate users.
And the labels and the studios are saying that you have to pass all three of them?
No. It's sort of a mishmash. They kind of, essentially what I get out of this, here's, you know, pick a card, any of these three. If you select any of these three and find them guilty, we're happy. There's three different tests. And then they even have a fourth. It's not quite a test. It's a change to the vicarious liability standard. Because as I've said earlier in our other conversations,
so they're saying you know, if we can't get nail them on one or two of these three, then all we need is one of these.
That's all he needs, one. They're separate tests. They're not like a combination.
You know, that's kind of like saying every startup company has to be profitable in the first year.
Yeah, of course, and or whenever they happen to be sued, at the moment they get sued. And if you think about this, and this goes more to the government. The government has a little more sophisticated version of the commercial success test. They have I call it the so central to business model test. And they have a little more lengthy and a little more thoughtful test, but it still doesn't work, which says that if the viability of the defendant's business over time, and they don't say what time, depends on the revenue and consumer interest generated by the illegal activity, then they're guilty. You know, the problem with that is, first of all, as you say, a startup, you know, it's very hard. Who knows what they're never profitable anyway, number one, regardless of what use is being made of it. And number two, that'll change over time, as even the government admits. Number three, courts aren't suited to make these kinds of decisions. I mean, you're really talking about having battling MBA accountants figure out how do you allocate costs. I mean, it's just like an impossibility to do this test. And again, you know, how is an innovator who's trying to do it like podcasting or something really unique going to know how this is all going to shake out? I mean, if you take Bram Cohn, although there's an interesting question as to whether BitTorrent is a business or not, right? Is he a business?
I don't know.
But assume he is, because he takes contributions.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole idea, I'm trying to remember which I've heard his interview. I don't know if it probably wasn't yours, but somebody interviewed him.
I did.
Oh, you did? Yeah. I heard yours. And it was very clear, unless I'm misremembering, that he said, look, I invented this for two reasons. One, to be able to more quickly and efficiently distribute source code for open source, and to distribute all this great music that bands allow people to record and distribute from their concerts.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, how do you measure, whether, and you and I know that BitTorrent is used for a lot of illegitimate transfers, but how do you go analyze that business? And how's a court to judge that? And indeed, it, you know, who knows whether how far or how wide open source will go.
All right, so you, I think it's interesting also that you said that some artists actually filed some briefs here.
Yeah, Chuck D and a bunch of artists I'm not familiar with, but I'm not a teenager anymore. Except I'm familiar with one of them, Janice Ian, which is an interesting story. You know, she'd like been nominated for 9 Grammys, won 2. She was a popular artist in the 60s. And I'm now admitting my age if I know her, right? But she, her career was in the toilet. And no label was interested in signing her, even though she's doing new music and stuff. She opened a website, has put stuff on peer-to-peer to be distributed, and guess what? Not that she's making millions, but she's now making a living because people are coming to her website from the peer-to-peer software that's being, you know, her peer-to-peer songs that are being exchanged and buying her albums. She's actually earning a good living. Now, no label would touch her because she can't go double platinum.
All right. Now, so now that you filed a brief and you've expressed your point of view and you've had a chance to inspect the arguments from the labels and the studios. Are you permitted on behalf of Intel to say, oh, now that I've looked at those arguments, I have these additional comments?
I'm sorry, Phil, I'm not quite following. I mean, the
all right, so you filed a brief for Intel.
Sure.
Okay, and that says,
and that brief stands for itself.
That stands for itself. But here's what you say. Here's our brief on behalf of Intel about what we think. Now, also, since you know the labels and the studios filed a brief.
Well, they filed first, and our brief is the answer to them.
Okay, so you inspected their arguments.
Oh yeah, we read all 30 of the top side briefs. Those were filed. Those were filed back in January.
Okay, so then what you've done is you have addressed your thoughts and Intel's thoughts on
right.
those three what are they called, tests.
Well, it's more than three. We also expressed our opinion on the other tests as well, because as I said, there's probably 28 different tests. If you read all 30 briefs, which is, I don't recommend it, unless you're really a glutton for punishment. The petitioners and the amici on the top side, not all of them, of course, as I said, BSA and DEIM are fairly similar to Intel's position. There's some 28 different tests that are proposed, at least I counted. And none of them have ever been, ruled on by a court or applied in the real world.
Well, now, what happens now? You're saying that the clerks of the court will intensively study these briefs.
Right, and there's two more procedural deadlines.
Okay, what happened?
On March 22nd, the petitioners, the music and movie industry, are permitted to file reply briefs, which I'm sure they will do. And then on March 29th, there's a standing room only oral argument, which I might not even be able to get in at the Supreme Court.
Who's going to make these arguments?
My understanding is one of the lawyers for the movie and record industry, I'm told it's Don Verrilli. They've got really good lawyers on their side, Phil. They're really excellent.
The best justice money can buy?
I didn't say that. Well, frankly, the good news is the respondents, the Grokster & Strink, has hired a very, very good Supreme Court, ex-Supreme Court clerk named Richard Taranta, who's very smart. Their brief is really well done. So he'll be arguing the other side.
So that's the Grokster brief?
Yeah, that's the Grokster Strinkcast brief. They combined and filed one brief. And it's a very well done brief. In fact, many of the briefs filed on our side, I think, are in terms of quality better than the ones filed on the top side. I disagree heartily, of course, with the petitioners.
That's the 29th of March.
March, right.
And
then
that's before the justices.
Right, that's before all the justices, assuming Rehnquist well enough to sit. They will all be there. They will pepper each side with questions. And then they go into the period where we don't know what they're doing, and we know they're considering the case. Drafts are being circulated. Clerks are working diligently and giving their views and helping write drafts of the court's final decision.
Well, without being any kind of an expert or just a complete neophyte here, my guess would be that you can kind of judge where the justices come from based on their questions.
Well, hard to tell. I think you can if you know where the judges have been before. So you know that O'Connor was the swing vote on the original Sony case. And that she'll probably go that direction. There's all these Supreme Court watchers, and it'd probably be boring for your audience to hear all this different stuff, but there are all these sort of reading the tea leaves. Part of the problem is you can't always tell from a justice's question. In fact, I think I mentioned this last time. Sometimes the justices like to be hard on the side they'd ultimately support, so when, if they get together and talk about the case, they can say, oh, look, I beat up on them, and they answered it well.
I see.
Other judges, a fascinating thing we don't have time to talk about is the broadcast flag oral argument where the FCC was challenged. There, one of the judges just wears his opinion right on his sleeve, and you can tell. So you have to be careful about that, because some of the justices will ask both sides hard questions.
But as a pragmatic factor, what's going on right now is the clerks are intensively studying.
I assume they're reading, because there's a lot to read, and you don't want to wait till last moment. They're probably reading and summarizing the briefs. I was not a Supreme Court clerk. Some days I wish I had been, because I think it must be a great experience.
So at some point, these clerks will sit down with the justices that they've been hired by and say, here's our analysis of what...
Well, or the justice may say, look, this is what I think. I want you to go do some research on this and tell me if my what you find.
I see.
Different justices use their clerks different ways. Some justices draft absolutely everything themselves. If you, again, there's no, you don't get a lot of intelligence out of the Supreme Court. There are some people who have talked after they've worked there. But, you know, justices have their individual styles. But clerks are very important, and, you know, they do research for the justices. Some probably do some drafting. And they're, as I said before, they're extremely bright people. They're the best of the best.
And you also, you sent me a brief email prior to this interview saying that you felt hopefully this would be decided before the summer.
Yes, that's my hope. The Sony case, they didn't manage to do that. And so it took 2 years to have that case decided, and they had a second oral argument to sort of refresh everyone's recollection, I guess.
What if Rehnquist chooses to resign or before then, and would you have 8 justices?
Yes, you would have 8 until a replacement was given advice and consent in the Senate. You know, appointed, you know, nominated by the president, and the Senate gives their advice and consent. And that, of course, is sort of scary because you could have an 8-8 decision. Now, that would mean the Ninth Circuit's decision is affirmed, but without really, you know, a solid court opinion. I mean, some people have told me they don't think 5-4, which was the vote in the Sony case, is a solid opinion. I would disagree and say we've had 21 years of quietude for innovators, and look where we are. I mean, if you believe Alan Greenspan, most of the prosperity and advancement we've had in our economy the past 6 years has been due to information technology innovation.
Yeah, and I can't say to you off the record because, you know, we're not off the record.
No, we're not.
But the thing is that as a pragmatic consideration, it doesn't really matter because, I mean, if whatever happens here in the States, if there's a really evil, malicious pirate out there, he's just going to go offshore.
Well, there's a couple points there. You're absolutely right. It's not a question of off the record. It's a fact.
Yeah.
And the Consumer Electronics Association brief makes much of this, which they're absolutely right, which is all you're going to do is drive all this stuff offshore because the Internet doesn't have national boundaries. You're going to make American innovators timid. International innovators won't be. We're going to drive innovation offshore. And, you know, programs, like, even if you shut Grokster and Streamcast as businesses down tomorrow, their software runs without them. So it is a Pyrrhic victory. And the concern, I think, that Intel, and not just Intel, that all the technology industries have in common on this, I'm talking about telecommunications, consumer electronics, and information technology, is that it appears that what's being asked here is that the content industry get a seat at the design table for all these products, feeling that they can only control the design of information technology, telecommunications, and consumer electronics equipment, that the world will be safe for their content. Now, all I can say in response to that is look at the history. And the history is each of these technologies that at the time they thought was going to destroy their businesses created great wealth for them.
Yeah.
You know, look at the Sony case. Now, they will tell you, we're only objected to record, and if they'd only sold Sony machines that didn't record, we'd be okay. Forgetting that some of their own members had invested in machines that wouldn't record prior to the Betamax, as you and I know, is really the VHS that took off. And those all failed. Consumers didn't want something that they could just play tapes or discs that they, you know, rented or bought from the movie industry. You needed an install base to make pre-recorded work, and so he did. Radio, I mean, the music industry was adamantly opposed to radio, the devil's instrument, giving their music away for free. They wind up paying, the radio winds up becoming their advertising agency, and they pay them to play their music. You know, all these technologies ultimately lead to good. I mean, I think that we're seeing where iTunes is doing, and I was listening to your Weed interview. I mean, there's a lot of exciting technology that's coming along that I think is ultimately going to make the recording industry a lot of money. And I just am concerned for innovation. If the Supreme Court limits the Sony case, overturns it, or qualifies it somehow, I'm just afraid of the results. And your point about offshore is really important.
Well, will you come and back on the show after the 29th and tell us what the oral argument is?
Absolutely. I hope I get in, or I think C-SPAN has it the next day, so I will listen to it one way or the other.
Okay.
I'm delighted to come back, Phil.
All right. Well, then, for Jim Berger and Phil Lee and Inside Digital Media.